So, and until that, we now hear Neil with the talk on online safety laws and the learnings from a lot of pro bono work. So, Neil, the floor is yours.
Can you hear me at the back? Is the microphone working? The microphone is not working. It is working, but you can't hear me at the back. Okay, thank you. Thumbs up. Put it back on. Right. Hello, I'm Neil. Some of you I know, some of you I don't know. I'm a lawyer, I'm afraid. Look, nobody's perfect. I would normally say I'm not your lawyer, but looking around, I actually am your lawyer for some of you here. So for those of you where I'm not your lawyer, I'm not your lawyer. For those of you who I am your lawyer, I am still your lawyer, and I hope to be your lawyer at the end of this as well. Okay, so I run a small law firm, and I run it almost entirely on free software. And I've spent a huge amount of time over the last 12, 18 months looking at online safety laws and free software communities. So that's looking both at people who run free software in a way that brings it within scope of online safety laws, and also people who develop free software, which, when people run it, brings them in scope of online safety laws. So I'm talking today predominantly from the point of view of people running these services, but it also has an impact on people developing these services, developing the software that powers these services. What can be built into things to help with some of this? So I'm talking about online safety laws, and I'm an English lawyer. I can only advise on English law, but other places are thinking about online safety laws as well. So although my focus is on the UK's Online Safety Act, there are online safety laws in Australia. There are online safety laws in some states in the USA, and there's an awful lot of conversation about other online safety laws in other countries as well. And they're not all the same. They're not all the same. So if you're running a project that's available globally, how do you think about compliance? What I'm going to do, I'm going to paint a background picture first, not quite how we got to here, but this is where we are. And then talk through some of the considerations, some of the mitigations, some that I've spoken with others here over the last year or so. What can you do about some of these things? But your starting question is, okay, all these countries have got or are developing online safety laws. That's nice. So what? Unfortunately, much as it would be great to be able to care only about the laws that apply in your country, lots of these laws purport to have extraterritorial effect. In other words, they claim to apply to people outside their country, and not to people outside their country, where the servers are outside the country as well. Now, I say purport because what the law says and what can be enforced aren't necessarily the same thing. Okay? So I take an example from the UK. The UK telecoms regulator has just imposed a £1 million fine for breach of the online safety laws. They've imposed this fine against a provider in Belize who has never engaged with any of the regulator's correspondence. Hands up if you think that fine's going to be paid. And I don't know whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, but yes, either way, there may be a purpose to bringing that, to imposing that fine, to simply say, look, we can. But to me, the chances of actually being able to get that fine paid to them has got to be really rather limited. But these laws are claiming to have extraterritorial effect. We'll talk a bit later, perhaps, about assessing the risk as to whether you really need to be worried about the extraterritorial effect of somebody else's laws. So you've got a starting point. The laws aren't always the same in all the countries. You've got the second point, that sometimes these laws say they apply to people outside the country. They may apply to you, even though they're the laws of a completely different country. And they vary in terms of their scope. Okay? Who here uses Nextcloud? Jitsi. Mastodon. Who follows me on Mastodon? I'm so sorry for that. Loads and loads of everyday services brought within scope. Okay, now, different countries take different approaches. So I say brings them within scope. I'm thinking from a UK point of view. Okay, from a UK point of view, the Online Safety Act encompasses services which lots of FOSS projects use. The Australian approach is to name specific services and to apply the rules to those. That's a fundamentally different approach. So you've got different countries adopting it in completely different ways. You may recognise some of these services. And while you're reading that, I'm going to try and reattach this. Can you hear me at the back still? Sort of, yes, but I'm judging by the fact you did anything at all means you can sort of hear me. Okay, so a whole load of things brought within scope. And much of the work I've done over the last year has been about these kind of things. A free software project that wants to have a forum for its users, that wants to have an online tool for collaborative generation of translations. This is not the kind of thing that you hear about in Parliament. This is not the kind of thing that comes up in online safety discourse and says, someone has been reading Arch Wiki. And nevertheless, wikis could be in scope. A service that allows users to see what other users have written in Bash. All sorts of things. And so we've got a plethora of different laws in different countries. We've got countries that say that their laws apply to you even if they're not in those countries. And we've got different scopes of those laws, some of which cover services that most of you will use multiple times a day. So what? Okay. We talked through how we got to here. This is some of my thinking on perhaps what can we do about this. Now, inevitably, what you do will depend on your own situation, which is another way of the lawyer's standard of it depends. Okay? These are things that I've drawn on in the last year or so. And the first one, can I just ignore it? Can I let it all go away? And the answer is, yeah, potentially, yes. But it would be sensible to approach it in a pragmatic way. And what is the genuine risk of enforcement activity? Are you doing the kind of things, you know, is a regulator going to be interested in you? Because it's one thing for the law to say it does apply to you, and it's quite another thing to find yourself a regulatory target. Okay? Now that is something that's much easier to assess as a law is has been on the statute books for a while, with experience. You can see some regulators publish regulatory priority lists. You can get a sense from public discourse of the kind of services that people care about. You can make an assessment that, you know, maybe the forum for discussing predominantly among contributors of a particular software project probably isn't as high up the list as some very large popular online platform. There's still an element of risk in that, but you could make an assessment that that risk is relatively low. You can make an assessment that the risk at that point in time is relatively low and keep watching and see how things develop. But you may very well come to the conclusion that yes, there are online safety laws in various countries, that there are various laws that require different things in different countries, and your plan is to do absolutely nothing, at least for now. That's a consideration. Okay. So that's thinking about things from what risk does the regulation present to you? What's the realistic risk of enforcement? You could also look at this from the perspective of your own services, or if you're developing software, the risks that someone running your software would face. What actual risks does your software or does your service pose? Can you try and mitigate that? There are different ways of doing that. I think a risk assessment makes sense. There are lots of different ways of doing risk assessments, and different laws may require you to consider different things or to do your risk assessments slightly differently. From my point of view, having some form of risk assessment, and I know some of you in this room have done online safety related risk assessments because I've read some of your online safety related risk assessments. I know how to party. They are not all the same. But what they have each done is shown that someone has engaged with a subject matter, that they've tried to think through the risks that apply to their service. So while some regulators may say, you should do it this way, and some laws say, no, you should do it this way, if you see it simply as a tool to think through risks in a structured way, great. And okay, different laws, different regulators may require different things. But if you are working on a free software project, in a lot of cases, this will be volunteer labour. This will be volunteer time and this will be volunteer skills. Maybe you don't have the resources to cover every single different risk assessment, to do it in every single different way. Maybe in an ideal world you could. But if a regulator does come knocking and you've done something, hey, you've done something. You've got something to show here that you didn't completely brush it to one side. You weren't saying, I've done nothing at all. You're saying, I've tried to engage with this in a way that's appropriate to our scope, our scale, and our services. Will that sort of, look, we've got something, will that always fly? No, nothing will always fly. But it seems like a sensible way to try and approach it. And there are some things that are going to come up almost irrespective of the country. Okay? If you run a service that particularly aims at having child users, you are likely to be a high-risk service. And there'll be many people who run services that don't aim to have child services, but nor do they completely discourage them. If you run a wiki for a niche Linux or BSD project, you probably do have child users, but you're probably not encouraging child users. So have a think. Is what you're doing massively attractive to children, you know you're going to get loads of them, or you know you've got loads of them, or is it the kind of thing where you may, but probably not particularly attractive? Services, which involve pornography. So alongside the work I do with free software, the other part of my pro bono work is predominantly for sex workers. Pornography comes up quite a lot in that context. In the free software world, I'm going to park that for now, but if you find that you have a forum or a community where people are regularly posting pornographic images or other pornographic content, that will be something to consider as part of a risk assessment from under almost any online safety law. Child sexual abuse material, so whether that's a potential for grooming or a potential for image distribution or video distribution, again, high priority, as is the terrorist bucket. Now, unfortunately, terrorism means different things to different people. Trying to determine what is terrorist content may vary by country, but if you were to think through those four things for most services, you are covering things that most countries are likely to have at the top of their priority list. Others will have other things too. That's not exhaustive. Those are the things that I've seen come up time and time again in different countries. So that's if you want to take an approach of what do we need to do to at least try and be compliant? What if you wanted slightly more than that? What if you actually wanted to do some good with this process? Could you move beyond compliance, move from a mindset of what do we need to do to keep the regulator off our backs, to actually, how could we use this to keep our users, our community safer? Can you create a better, safer experience for all users, but especially your more vulnerable users? And when you start thinking through the online safety laws from that perspective, how can you do better? How can you build a better, richer, stronger, more inclusive community? You start seeing things slightly differently, and it moves away from being a regulatory tick box exercise into a, oh, just a minute. Yeah, that could be used in a harmful way, but it's still a useful feature. What could we do about it? How can you lessen the risk of either the abusive use or the misuse of the services that you're operating for your community or the software that you're developing? Okay, so we know how we got to here. Kind of considerations, what tangibly could be done? I'm going to split this into three, but fundamentally, the mitigations that you deploy will depend on the risk that you've identified. It's very hard to try and mitigate something where you haven't already considered it to be a risk. So I come back to that idea of a risk assessment. And if you are going to mitigate those risks, write them down as well. Because then you can show if somebody comes, look, not only have we thought about it, we thought about what's an appropriate proportionate solution that's available within our budget, time, resources and whatever. We can show we're thinking about these things in a way that a regulator's likely to see a mature organisation, a mature community. Okay, so your mitigations, based on your risk assessment, you've thought about them, you've started to document them. The first thing I talk about is something that Karen talked about as she opened the room today. Setting standards and upholding them. Clear, enforced rules or codes of conduct. Accessible to everyone in plain language. There's no secret code of conduct. There's no convoluted legalese. It simply sets out these are the standards of behaviour that are expected and that they apply to everyone. Now, this is an area where I've seen numerous contexts and also free software projects that the rules may not apply to everyone equally. Very difficult to enforce a framework where some people get special treatment and others don't. Okay? But I'd start clear behaviours, this is what we expect, this is what happens if you don't. Okay? The second bucket is reactive, dealing with harm that's already happened. Now I'd hope by your risk assessment you've already identified that these are relatively low risk harms, because if you've got high risk harms you don't want to be dealing with these after these happened, because it means that someone must have suffered through them by that point. So when you look at features in a social media application, for example, to block somebody or to mute someone, yes, you can use them proactively, but chances are most people do it after they've already suffered the conduct in question. They're typically reactive features. Obvious things that come up. Who does a user go and talk to if they have a problem with something? Not all services have an easy, obvious report button. If they do, great, as long as it's backed up by action. But if that isn't there, and if you can't introduce it because the service doesn't have that feature, is it clear and prominent who they should go and talk to? Who do they need to report something to? Does the person to whom they report stuff know what they need to do? Who handles the reports? How do they handle it? Are the sanctions, the consequences documented somewhere so that someone who's acting as that moderator, someone who's acting in that role of investigating whatever, they know what they need to do and they can apply those standards consistently, repeatedly and easily? Okay, that's the one I see most people, most organisations slip up on, is they've kind of thought about it, they've got a code of conduct, but a report comes in and then there's a panic. And there's a panic because they're not sure who's dealing with it, who's already dealt with it, who's commented on the forum thread about it. That it doesn't need to be massively difficult. You're not trying to write your own procedural rules akin to a court. Just something, bless you, just something clear and simple that you can apply equally. But this is where something bad's already happened. Someone is reporting it. You're going in to stop, to put out the fire that's already started. What could you do to stop that in the first place? Where you're really looking at these high-risk harms, it's what can you do proactively, trying to prevent the harm from happening. So, again, it will depend on the service in question. An awful lot of harm sometimes someone sees comes from services where anyone can use them. Just simply sign up, off you go, you can start posting. There are good reasons for making things easier to use, for reducing barriers to entry. I'm not saying never do it. But when you've assessed the risk and context of your service, maybe having some form of manual approval step before people can start using them could reduce the risk but still make your service useful. Could users have different functionality? Does every user need the ability to send an encrypted direct message to every other user the moment that they sign up? Do they need to be able to send an encrypted direct message containing an image to everyone who's just when they've just signed up? The vector for abuse is very obvious. There could be good reasons, but there are also very obvious abuse vectors. So can you differentiate based on user time, duration of use of the service, or number of different facets? And the third one, I've written it, I feel it's a little pointed, but kind of with reason. I love Jitsi, I use Jitsi. I do look at Jitsi instances. So Jitsi, for those who don't know, is fantastic free software video conferencing service. It runs in your browser. You don't need a client for it. you join using a meeting name, somebody else joins using a meeting name, you have a video chat. A fantastic tool for all sorts of things, including CSAM content. A fantastic tool for having a meeting to which someone else joins and starts broadcasting pornography or CSAM content. So if you run a Jitsi or other video conference server, one of my first thoughts from a risk assessment point of view is, do you really need anyone to be able to start that conference? Could you look at locking it down a bit? The last thing I'd touch on is community knowledge sharing. Not everything I've done for the Online Safety Act, but an awful lot of it, I've put online, onlinesafetyact.co.uk, risk assessments, sample terms and conditions, all sorts of things, because these frameworks are onerous. They are challenging, particularly if you're not used to dealing with them. The more we can pool knowledge about how other services have done it, the more we can build up that baseline and get to a good place. Now, there may also be scope for knowledge sharing about bad servers, bad actors, problems and things. Now, when you start sharing information about individuals, you might also want to think from a data protection point of view. But thank goodness I'm not doing a data protection talk this afternoon. Just to flag, there may be value in doing that. It may be perfectly legitimate to do that. You may find a perfectly good legal way of doing it. There will be data protection considerations when you start sharing information about individuals. Now, the other thing that I pondered talking about but decided in 30 minutes not going to, age verification. It's a topic that's coming up in all sorts of different countries. Again, not all asking for the same thing. Should it be device-based? Should it be browser-based? I think the one that worries me the most is the idea that before one visits a pornography site, you should turn on your camera and prove that you are an adult. This doesn't seem particularly well thought through, but that's the level of the dialogue in some places at the moment. So I won't talk through that. I think it's an issue that will come up and we will need to deal with in the free software community. But with 3 or 4 minutes remaining, what questions do you have?
Thank you. So since you've touched upon this already, so say you want, instead of launching a Jitsi instance, so say you want to launch on Mastodon one single user server or a Matrix server or anything else, let's say a Bookworm server, anything, what would you recommend to do?
So the question related to a Fediverse server, was it a single user server, did you say?
Yes.
So I have a single user Mastodon service. Some people will say that's still one user too many. I can't remember whether I've done a risk, I may have done a risk assessment or not. I don't think many online safety laws are designed to deal with someone's own speech in the same way of what they write on their own blog. The way some Fediverse servers work means other users may be able to, their posts may be effectively relayed through your server, you may be able to search someone else's posts. I've locked all that functionality down on my server. People can only see what it is that I post, for better or worse. And at that point, I think I'm quite comfortable with the risk. If I were to run, say, a Matrix server or an XMPP server in our family, as I do, I haven't bothered about a risk assessment for that. If I were to allow other people to sign up for it, I would be thinking far more carefully about it. Okay.
Hi. I know you're British, but...
Sorry.
Do you happen to be able to shed any light on any upcoming European laws? I'm a complete lay, have no idea which kinds of laws are coming up, and the names of these laws, where to find more information about them in this notoriously opaque process.
So are there any other European laws coming up to deal with this? I don't know if there are specific legislative proposals. Others might. What I'm seeing is a general direction of travel along this kind of lines. I don't have a specific citation for you, I'm afraid. Talk tomorrow about it at 12. Okay. Sorry, I wasn't saying you should talk tomorrow about it at 12, but there is a talk tomorrow about it at 12. Matthias.
Hi. I'm setting up a hackspace, and instead of having it be that members can visit websites over the internet, I was thinking about using Tor hidden services and having DNS point to V6 addresses and onion addresses And this way, no one on the internet can visit my website unless they have, well, yeah, if I put it in DNS, they would know. But the idea is I would share the hidden service with people physically, maybe on a piece of paper, and now they can visit the website over the internet. Do you think that that is a valid solution to some of these problems?
So is running something as a Tor hidden service a way of avoiding regulatory risk? I run Tor hidden services. All of my work websites and stuff are behind Tor hidden services. No, not fundamentally. If you've got users, you've got users. You might be able to thwart basic regulatory investigations, but there are an awful lot of people also using Tor hidden services for user-to-user stuff that regulators and law enforcement agencies know perfectly well about. So do it because it's good for privacy, do it because it's good for security, probably not a great regulatory risk mechanism.
Please all join me with a big round of applause for Neil.